Hello everyone, welcome to the Philosophy Exchange podcast. This is the fifth episode and I'm joined here today by Johanna and Jorge. Today we will discuss about analogies in philosophy and science. Analogies are quite ubiquitous both in philosophy and also in science. We use a lot of analogies, particularly also in the ancient times. It was quite common to use analogy to conduct kind of argument. So you take a system, for example, and you compare it with another system, another process, another object, and you find out that there are some interesting properties that are shared by both the systems that you're investigating. And then you want to conduct some kind of inference. For example, the second system, say the universe, is really complicated object, is really a complex thing. And so you try to investigate its properties by comparing it with an object that you think you know a little bit better, for example, the human body. This was a typical analogy used in ancient times. Ancient Greeks used to describe the cosmos as an organism. And this kind of inference was used not only towards the universe, but for example, also for describing a nation or a community. This was because we thought that we knew the human body in a better way, in a more accurate way. This is not true only about philosophy. It's true also about science. It's typical to say that models in a certain way, model-based inferences, work really in a similar way than an analogical reasoning. And so you study a model that is like simpler, easier to manipulate kind of representation of the system that you want to study. You study the model, and at a certain point, you try to infer some properties about the system, the real phenomenon that you want to investigate. This inference is based on the fact that the model and the phenomenon should share some kind of interesting properties. The question now is how we can assess the value and the reliability of an analogy. And so when we can trust an analogy, both in philosophy and in science. Now, I will stop talking because I'm really curious to listen to what you guys think about this. So what do you think, Jorge?
Yeah, hi. I think that's a very good point where we can start our discussion about analogies. I will start to open the discussion by making some examples. I brought two examples, one of an analogy that I think is not good since it doesn't convince me, and another one which I consider to be really good, because I think it really gives me some understanding about the system. The first analogy is maybe known to some of you, the watchmaker analogy, which establishes an analogical relation between the universe and its intricate and often disguised laws, which physicists were discovering since Newton, and the watch, which also at first view has some hidden mechanisms. Now, the argument goes that since the universe and the watch share the property of having some underlying mechanisms, it must be that these mechanisms were put there by a designer, a watchmaker in the first case, and some kind of god in the second one. I will not say anything about it, and I will just give the other one, the what I consider the good analogy, and then we can talk about it. So the second one is maybe a bit more complicated. I've been reading Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene. So it tries to explain and give some understanding about the notion that natural selection is not on the level of the individual or a species or a population, but rather happens on the level of genes. The analogy goes as follows. Genes are analogous to rowers in a rowing team. Now, the genes are the rowers, and the pool of alternative candidates is the gene pool. The rowing team is the genome, or the genes that maybe define an organism. And rivals for a seat in the rowing team are alleles, genes that have the same function, but are not the same. For example, the gene for blue-colored eyes and the gene for brown-colored eyes are alleles. Now, his point is that a gene is competing against its alleles, and he illustrates this following. He says, rowing is a cooperative venture, and there's good rowers and there's maybe less good rowers, even though it's cooperative. So it depends on how good are the rowers, and also depends on the success of the boat, depends on how well they work together, they row together. Now there's a coach, and he puts teams together at random in order to choose the best team, the winning team. which might be analogous to sexual reproduction, which would be the random shuffling of the genes together, and the survival of the fittest, which is the best team. Now, a rower which cooperates well with others will be rather in a winning team, and a rower which is a good rower will also be rather in a winning team. Now, how good a gene is dependent on its team. The success of the rower will depend on its team, and the success of the team will vice versa also depend on the rower, and so on. So this is maybe not so easy to grasp, that my performance depends on you guys' performance, and you guys' performance depends on my performance, and so on. So it's a reciprocal relationship that we have. Now, although the whole genome is selected, so to speak, the configuration of the genes, which alleles are in this genome, are random. The competition is rather between rivals for a specific position in a rowing team than between teams. I think this analogy helps me to comprehend this notion of the selfish gene better, which is more focused on the gene, not on the individual level, and explains natural selection in that way.
I have a question, I think, because it seems to me that the two examples are fundamentally different in the way that they are created as tools of gaining knowledge. So in one case, in the watchmaker analogy, you have a system that you observe in nature. You have the watchmaker that you observe. And from that, you conclude something which is maybe a little bit unrelated. So you look at the watch, you see how it's designed, you see how perfect it is, and say, oh, there must be somebody behind it. So that's the watchmaker. And then you take that to a completely different level and say, oh, we have the world, which is like perfectly designed, so there must be something behind it, right? But in the analogy of the rower, my question would be, how was the analogy conceived? Was it first that he understood the mechanism and then looked for an analogy in nature? Or was it rather the case that he looked at the rowing team and was like, oh, maybe that's how genes work?
Well, I would say it's the first way. It's not, I mean, first, the natural selection was understood, and then he presented it by a rowing team. However, I would say that the same can be said about the watchmaker analogy. It's not about the watch or the watchmaker. It's about two systems having some kind of properties which they share, and to infer some conclusion out of it. Now, I say in both arguments, first, I establish this analogical relation, and then I say something which goes beyond the relation itself, which is not self-contained in the assumptions.
So I was thinking, I personally find some kind of disanalogies between the two examples that you made. So let's focus on the first one first. Why the argument is actually not convincing? I think that here there is an argument. So the idea is that we don't know if the universe is designed or not, but we can say that it's quite perfect. So it's like working really well. And what is in our world that works really well? Something that was organized before. And so the best explanation that we can give of this perfection of the mechanisms regulating the universe is hypothesizing the existence of someone that was organized and structuring it. The problem with this analogy is that we have in our very world examples of creatures that are working pretty well without being constructed by anybody. So like living organisms.
Somebody who believes the analogy believes that they are. No.
Exactly.
So this is the problem here. I think that for an analogical reasoning to be reliable, you cannot assume the similarity that you want to conclude with your arguments in the first place. So you cannot assume already that the universe is designed. You're just making a metaphor. So you're just comparing two things that you know that are similar. And so you say, to illustrate or to make you understand what I mean when the universe is working really well, I'm saying that is like a watch. Also because, and not as a consequence of my comparison, I say that they are both designed. I think Leibniz or Immanuel Kant, people that were using this argument, they were convinced that this was a good argument. So they were not assuming from the beginning that the universe was designed. Instead, in the second case, the selfish gene, I'm struggling to see what is the inference that we are drawing after the comparison. Does the author also like infer something about the gene that we don't know, but that we know about the team participating in the game? This was because I think this is the difference between the two cases. In one, you are inferring something new. In the second case, I'm not sure if there is something new inferred by the comparison or it's just an illustration for our own understanding.
The second is then more actually like a tool of explanation rather than a tool of inference as the first one.
Yeah, well, I would say they both have that in common. I mean, I don't think that Paley saw a watch and then said, oh, this is just like the universe. No, he had a preconceived picture of the universe and he made it graspable by using the watch. Same as Dawkins have some conception of how natural selection works. And he explains this by using a rowing team. Now, why do anybody does this? And this is, I think, also a good question. Because we might be more acquainted with a rowing team or a watch than with the universe or with natural selections, things that are unobservable. So I think it is the case that Dawkins' argument of the rowing team produces a novel finding, which is that the competition in rowing teams and in genomes is on the gene level.
Do you think that we have like, there's somewhat of an intuitive component towards assessing one as successful versus the other, where we have like very strong intuitions to towards our belief if God exists or not, and if so, what her role is? And I wouldn't really say I have any strong intuition about how genomes work. So if somebody comes with that rowing analogy, I'm like, yeah, fair enough, sounds good, I'm convinced.
Just intuitively, I would say that a similarity in properties is really far from being enough to create a reliable analogy. So Nelson Goodman, philosopher of language, famously said once that everything can be similar to anything else. A good criterion for me, at least, would be to say the number of properties that are similar in the two systems that you're comparing. The relevance of these similarities, this is really context dependent. You may want to say that the color of the eyes of a person is not really important, like in a moral philosophy example or investigation, but it could be really important for traits that are inherited by generations. At the same time, we don't have only the number of properties and the relevance of properties, but maybe also the connection among all the properties. I don't know what you think.
I don't know. It's like thinking about like the similarity of properties makes me kind of think that I would attribute these characteristics more to like modeling and models, like what makes a model a good model of something and what makes something a good explanation of something. And then I would look for like similarities for like not only the, as you said, the quantity of similarities, but also the quality of similarities, right? Whereas in analogies, I think that is a tool where you do actually have the freedom to go into a completely different system that shares nothing but that one characteristic that you try to explain. For example, in the rowing boat analogy, nothing about a rowing team has any similar features to the genomes, except that one mechanism that Dawkins is trying to explain.
That's also the reason for which I would say that in a gene example, we have a good illustration of how the mechanism is working, but I would be really, really careful in inferring anything else from the comparison. Instead, if I want to infer something about the system that I don't know, I would say that you need more than one single similarity to infer something new. Otherwise, the analogy, if it's just a way to express yourself, a rhetorical device, so you want to be sure that people are understanding what you're saying, then the analogy can be even not strongly connected with other similarities. I don't know what you think about this. Maybe it's just a strong intuition. What do you think about it, Parvia?
Well, I would say these types of analogy that I presented are not same as models in that we don't gain new information or new knowledge here. Something new follows, but obviously these people, Paley and Dawkins, they chose their analogies very carefully so that their points are sound. But it's not by looking at rowing boats that I learn something about genes. It's rather that if we understand natural selection as a rowing team, we can explain this natural selection based on the individual level. And it would be interesting of somebody who believes, and there are these biologists, I think, that natural selection is on the individual level, how this person would put an analogy or how this person would explain his or her point. And I think the same goes with a watchmaker. It would be interesting to see how somebody who does not believe in God, who wants to make maybe the opposite point of Paley, uses an analogy to make the point that the universe is not designed. So the analogy itself doesn't give truth to the conclusion. It is, do we believe in it? I think that's the question. And this is different from models, because from models, I maybe get some new knowledge that I didn't know before. In a way, models work quite the same, but this is more, I think, an easier examples of looking at analogies, because now we can think about, why is it that I believe the first one, that I don't believe the first one, but I do believe the second one? And I think Johanna gave quite a good answer in saying that it is my previous knowledge that gives me some kind of way of making that decision. My understanding of natural selection was not as refined as Dawkins put it, but I was just not aware of these intricate distinctions.
I really want to like hone in on this thought that we all said at one point, this idea that analogies are good tools of making yourself clear, but they're not directly giving us a way of making new inferences or gaining new knowledge about something. And I think in order to make this point clear, I would like to introduce a new analogy that has been used to develop models about the human consciousness, how the mind works, and cognition. So that's basically the computer mind analogy. So the computer mind analogy became really famous throughout the cognitive revolution in the 1960s. And at the very center of that analogy is the idea that what humans do in cognition is processing information. So the model goes like input, some, for example, stimuli, some behavioral environment. Then there's a process which operates on that information. Then there's output, some behavioral output. In the case of the computer, the program would be a code that processes that information. And in the brain, it would be some sort of process that we're trying to explain, maybe like using information, storing information, retaining information, calculation capacities, what have you. And then the output is in terms of saying something, thinking something. Basically, that's the analogy. People have been using that analogy to explain the idea that what is going on inside the head is information processing. And then there have been other people who said, oh, well, let's actually use that to make the argument that the human mind is just like a computer and that cognition works in exactly that way. And I think that is the way the analogy starts to become problematic, and where a lot of people would actually say, well, let's not make any conclusions quite so quickly. Let's not make any conclusions about what consciousness is and how it works, because that's not what the analogy is telling us. So there's been, for example, Turing, who showed us a completely different side of the argument, who was just actually saying, let's just look if a computer can have the same behavioral output as a human mind. But he never says, let's draw any inferences from that onto how what's actually going on in the mind as well.
I think it's really fascinating. We tend nowadays to consider the mind as a kind of really complex sort of computer. I was wondering, as you're working on this, do you have some kind of this analogy in mind between the mind and the computer? So something that we are not actually allowed to infer about the similarity of the two systems.
Yeah, I think there are lots of different things, and I don't have like a refined list of these analogies, but I can give you some ideas. So when you look at a computer, for example, what's happening is we usually have a serial processing computer where like one thing is processed after the other. Whereas the brain is probably working in a parallel processing way, where like lots and lots of different things are processed at the same time. Then another disanalogy would just be the complexity of the input that you have in a computer versus the human brain. So in a computer, you have a lot of control over the stimuli. For example, you have the Turing machine, you put some sentences into like a question or whatever, and then the Turing machine processes on that question and gives you an answer to that question. But in real life, if I put you into my laboratory and I ask you a question, then you get that question with my intonation, you get that question with, you know, your mood that day, you get the question with my gender, the room color, whatever, if that makes any difference to the way you answer the question. So basically the one problem is that you can't generalize from these really unnatural laboratory experiments to real life settings.
I think the analogy of the computer to explain the human brain is very interesting, because it has a different position than the example of analogies that I made before, because it's rather there to somehow convince or explain or give some understanding about something. But since we cannot look into our brains, but we understand computers quite well, it's a way of understanding our brains. So this analogy is the object of investigation. This analogy is so important to the whole theory that their understanding of the brain depends on that analogy. I mean, it just shows how analogies may serve different purposes.
I was really fascinated by the explanation. Thank you, Johanna. And I totally agree with what Jorge said. I was wondering why it has this kind of pivotal role in the theory itself. And one answer that I gave to me is that it's not only the positive analogies, so the actual similarities that we can find between the two systems, but the instruments that we are using, so the computers and the machines and knowledge that we have about them, allow us also to find out some kind of these analogies. So something that's where the two systems are dissimilar. I think also these analogies are important sometimes. When you were talking about studying the computers to understand something about the mind, I didn't see many differences from what we normally do in science when we idealize and distort a lot of properties of our models or even about our experiments. So for example, when we study biomedicine and we make experiments on mice or fruit flies, we actually genetically engineer them so deeply. They are so different from the organisms that we find in reality. But actually, this possibility of modifying or manipulating them is even better because we can see the outcomes and the consequences and the causal relations in a clearer way. And we infer something about humans or other life beings. I just say this because I think that Johanna was talking about the impossibility of reducing the analogy to an identity. But I would say that this impossibility of reducing the analogy between computers and humans to an identity is actually a good thing, because even if they are not identical, we can discover a lot of things about them.
I think that's a very good point. Again, shows that analogies are so very important for our understanding of the world, since experimentation is basically an argument by analogy. I am experimenting on some kind of control system, say a fruit fly, and I'm making some discoveries on that system. And arguably, I don't want to say something about fruit flies. I want to say something about other organisms on which I could not do the same kind of experimentation. Now, how can I say something about people when I'm looking at fruit flies? Whatever I'm saying depends on how strong, how relevant maybe is the analogy in between those two systems.
I would really like to distinguish here between experiments doing research and analogical reasoning, because even if you do an experiment on fruit flies, nothing about that experiment gives you any reason to make any inference about other organisms. And no researcher would actually believe that she has found out something about the human brain by studying the fruit fly. Maybe she would want to say, well, I studied the fruit fly, I found that. Now I'm going to study a mammal and I still found effect X, I don't know. And now I'm going to try to infer by logical reasoning if that could also be the case in a human person. Whereas the way we were talking about analogies before, we were more like using them as a way of expressing the way a certain mechanism works. And I do think that they help you to come up with hypotheses and theories, which then you can test in the laboratory. But the analogy itself, that doesn't give you any reason to infer that analogy actually holds.
I think I totally agree with you, Johanna. And I was thinking that maybe what I had in mind when I was saying that experiments work as analogy, also Jorge said the same thing, is that we probably think that particularly in modern science, there is this kind of really abstract, highly controlled way to experiment. That seems like making really difficult to import the information outside of the laboratory out in the real world. I would say that normally an analogy to be reliable must be supported by some kind of assumptions. For example, in the case of organisms, we have some kind of theoretical assumptions that support this analogical reasoning. For example, we can say that if we find the same genetic mechanisms in different organisms, this means that these organisms share some properties by phylogeny. If two organisms that place themselves in two branches that are really far away from each other, then it's really plausible, it's really likely that also other organisms in different branches share the same properties. Instead, I was thinking about our first example, the watchmaker analogy. We have the analogy, but the assumption is not really strong. The assumption, I think, is that there cannot be a really perfectly working device without some kind of design informing it. So I think that this is never the analogy in itself, but it's all the background knowledge and particularly the theories that have been tested already that are supporting our trust in the analogy itself.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm talking to you, Jana. You're right, the experiment itself does not tell me how to apply this knowledge. But I think it's exactly as Lorenzo says. It's my knowledge, it's my theoretical knowledge about the systems that I can do this inference. And this is not empirical knowledge, this is what my understanding of the world allows me to do, rather the mere observation of the world. That is, I think, what makes science so interesting. It's not just looking at flies and then being able to say something about flies, but looking at flies and then being able to say something about totally different organisms. I thought about this argument that Professor Birch did, which I found quite fascinating. It's a practical argument. He's working on animal sentience. And he put this argument forward that since it's quite difficult and expensive to make tests on animals, and there are millions of species, better way to go about this is whenever sentience has been discovered on a species,
we can infer by analogy that other species of the same taxonomic rank, for example, the same family, also have sentience without necessarily having to do experiments on them.
It's a very practical way of going about assigning sentience to animals. If we have to experiment on each one of them, it would take years. So this analogical argument based on scientific evidence that they are sentient allows us to protect a larger number of animals, which might be much better for the welfare indeed.
Yeah, nice. Okay, now I think I got your point better than before. Thank you for the clarification. So would you agree with me that we would answer the question that we posed at the very beginning, what makes an analogy a good analogy, by saying, well, an analogy is in and of itself, first of all, just an idea or a form of expressing itself. And what makes it a good analogy is if it can be integrated into a broader theory or a model or some experimental knowledge that you gained.
Yes, I think that's a good way to put it. An analogy is maybe just as good as we as audience believe it to be. And that is dependent on whatever we believe the world is and whether argument is sound. But I mean, I don't know, maybe Lorenzo, maybe you have a better understanding of how do we discern these things. I would say it's almost case by case.
Yeah, sure. I totally agree on the fact that it's highly context dependent. I would say that even though it's really complicated to assess an analogy, it's really important to specify what are good things that we want to find in our argument in order to believe that our analogical argument is sound. I would say that for sure, the background knowledge or the initial conditions of our knowledge have to be considered in order to assess the value of an analogy or not. The second criterion that I would like to mention is how much fruitful is the analogy. Of course, it's just an a posteriori criterion, so we cannot just say from the beginning if an analogy would be fruitful or not. But I would say that it's always good to try to investigate as many analogies as we can, because we never know if an analogy will bring some scientists or some philosophers to understand or to infer something really interesting and new. And so I would say that there is a criterion that is the coherence with the rest of our knowledge and experience. And the a posteriori one is about the final fruitfulness of the analogy.
Maybe the a posteriori is not always possible in the case of the watchmakers. You cannot confirm it nor deny it.
Yeah, great. I think that concludes our session. I mean, there's so many things that we haven't answered yet or talked about, and they would be wonderful new episodes. If you are a listener right now listening in, stay tuned. We have lots of really interesting things to talk about and new members joining into the podcast. Jorge is also for the first time on the podcast today, which I'm really happy about. Yay! And if you are intrigued by who we are, what we're doing, and what's coming next, follow us on Instagram and Twitter on PhilXChange. So that's Phil and the X, just the letter X and then change. And thank both of you for this awesome episode.
Thank you, Joanna.
Thank you.
It was a blast. See you next time, and would love to see you guys back on the podcast.